Earth and Sky.
Welcome to Clear Voices. I'm Lindsay Patterson. Nanotechnology is an emerging field of science that controls matter at the level of individual molecules. The science works at scales too small to see, but how can one tell what kind of an impact nano is making on society? Earth and Sky's Jorge Salazar spoke with George Whitesides, a chemist at Harvard University who's a leading pioneer of nanotechnology. Whitesides talked about the current state and risk of nanotech.
Dr. Whitesides, thank you very much for taking this time out to speak with me. Welcome to Earth and Sky.
Glad to be here.
I'd like to ask you a big question right now. How would you like to describe the state of nanotechnology?
Nanotechnology today is in a stage where we're beginning to see what some of the general outlines of the field are going to be. And some of the topics and areas are ones that were expected at the beginning, and some are quite different. For example, you can ask, will there be something like nanotechnology, real technology? And the answer to that question is, remarkably, that there already is a major nanotechnology, which is what was microtechnology in electronics. The engineering of the wires in wiring and transistors in microelectronic devices has progressed amazingly rapidly, so that one will have in production in the immediate future devices which have wires and features that are 40 nanometers across. So that there's absolutely no question there is a nanotechnology. It will underlie much of information technology, and it's here and now. So that's settled down into something that's become remarkably firm and remarkably important in a very short period of time. A second area which has emerged and is perhaps a little bit surprising is energy. And in the area of energy, it turns out that much of energy production in one or another way involves either small things or small distances. So, for example, many systems that produce energy, from cracking petroleum to fuel cells, involve catalysis. And catalytic particles are often very small particles of matter of some kind, platinum or bismuth oxide or something, with dimensions down in the sizes of a few nanometers. This used to be called catalysis. We recognize now that we need new catalytic activities, and so there will probably emerge a new field of rational catalysis in nanometer scale particles focused on production of energy. Solar cells have attracted enormous attention, and there are pluses and minuses. They tend to be pretty expensive, but I think there's a lot of optimism that solar can be a very important contributor to the overall energy economy, and many of the characteristics and structures that make solar cells work are structures that have dimensions in the order of 50 to 100 nanometers. So again, that's emerged as a very important area. So information technology and energy are both big deals. What's not quite so clear are areas like, for example, biomedicine. There is great interest in the idea that a nanometer scale particle might be able to be delivered to tissue or permeate tissue or, with appropriate decoration on its surface, stick to particular kinds of cells or do interesting things. One can imagine lots of interesting possibilities. Those in general have not yet happened. There's a great deal of research going on with interesting results, but it's, you know, it hasn't happened. And then I would say the fourth area where lots is going on is in material science. And what are materials? Basically, materials are what the world is made of. So concrete and glass and metal. A material is a solid or sometimes a gel that has some function that's useful in making devices or machines or systems that we use. And the ability to control the scale of matter and the nanometer size turns out to be very important in designing and producing optimized materials. So those are four areas where I would say progress has been really spectacular in the last period of time, the last 5 years. Now, the one other thing which is probably worth mentioning briefly is, what about risks? And there were two classes of risks at the beginning that people were interested in. One was the sort of science fictiony idea of self-assembling robots, basically, which made themselves or performed astonishing functions. I think most of that has simply gone away. There's a general sense that the ideas were closer to science fiction than they were to science, and that this kind of concern, the so-called gray goo concern, is not really an issue. There is, however, another more rational interest. I don't think it's a great concern, but there is the other side of the biomedical story, which is that if one can use nanoparticles to deliver materials to cells, or if they can permeate into tissue, in biomedicine, that would be for good, but you could also ask if there's some particular toxicity associated with such particles. And I think the fair answer to that question is, right now, we don't really know. It's not obvious what it would be, but with something that gets into tissue and gets into cells, you do have to pay attention. So from that point of view, very small particles, nanoparticles, have to be treated as a new kind of molecular entity and run through the usual processes for looking for toxicology and bad effects. And who knows what will happen there. I don't think anything spectacular will happen, but I think it may turn out that one wants to be careful about certain classes of materials. So that's my summary of the current situation.
Dr. Whitesides, nanotechnology, I guess, it's been described as kind of the next industrial revolution. Is it fulfilling that some of the promises that have been made about it? In the news recently, there was news of a licensing agreement with Harvard and Nano, your company NanoTerra.
Is nanotechnology the next industrial revolution? I think the fair answer to that, to me, is no. And my argument there is the following, that what nanotechnology does is to deal with small structures or components that have the characteristic that they are parts of larger pieces, which are parts of larger pieces, which become parts of systems. And materials and small processes or structures can be very, very important, but they support the functions that society sees. So let's take an example. Would you say that silicon was the basis of an industrial revolution? Yes, in a sense, because after all, silicon is the material from which microelectronic devices are built, and then computers are built, and the World Wide Web is built. So from that point of view, it is the basis of a revolution. On the other hand, it's really the web that's the revolution. It's the uses of silicon and silicon-based devices. And I don't really know how you separate those two. Now, nanotechnology has the characteristic that it's very, very broad. I mean, essentially all materials and all functional systems have important nanometer scale things in them. So it's going to be a science and ultimately a set of technologies which will be enormously pervasive and which will enable energy production and enable new classes of electronic devices and maybe enable new kinds of therapy and other things. But from the point of view of people who are users and society, probably the nanoscale part of that is going to be invisible. Now, you can then form your own judgment as to, you know, whether this is the next industrial revolution. To me, it is a method of controlling matter in scales that are useful for a variety of purposes and which extend across almost everything that we do, because almost everything that we do has features that turn out to be important, by nanometer in size. So very broadly important, a little bit hard to perceive from the point of view of the user, and you can form your own judgment as to whether that's an industrial revolution or not. I tend to think of the web as an industrial revolution and not as the transistor as an industrial revolution, but you can take your own preferences there. Now, the issue of the Harvard license agreement. The event that was interesting to people was one in which Harvard licensed a fairly large group of patents, approximately 50 patents, to a small company. And that's it's an unusual thing to do. Typically, license agreements deal with one or two patents and fairly focused areas of application. So the question is, why did Harvard do it? And the answer to that in broad terms is that we have in the United States a wonderful, wonderfully entrepreneurial culture in which there is a process by which taxpayers support research in research universities. The research universities produce science, which with luck becomes technology. The technology is then spun out into companies, which creates jobs, goods, and services for the society, which paid the bill. And it really works pretty well. Now, this method, this process, has worked exquisitely in biomedicine, and it's worked, I think, quite well in information technology. And in general, it hasn't worked that well in other areas. And it hasn't worked that well for the reason that we were just discussing, which is that in material science, for example, the characteristics of materials or the characteristics of processes in the materials area typically are to improve the quality or lower the cost of a component which goes into another system, which goes into another greater system, which eventually appears as part of an automobile or an airplane or a computer. So it's hard to see. And technologies that build components for other systems are sometimes hard to value. So it's been a little difficult to understand how to do spin-off companies in which one is working in material science or one is working in these lower-level subsystems of bigger functional systems. And the Harvard decision to license a block of patents, I think, is an experiment to see if one gives a small company a commanding position in a technology, can it use that position through intellectual property to build enough strength that it becomes a successful and ultimately freestanding entity. So we'll have to see how the experiment works, but it is an experiment. It's a creative effort on the part of the university to understand how to use the technology in a way that results in a successful company. And from that point of view, I think there's a great deal of interest in both the idea of a new business model and in the way the university and the company are working together to try to find a successful method of transferring technology from the university into the society.
Dr. Whitesides, thank you very much. I appreciate taking this time out to speak with me.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Harvard nanotechnology expert George Whitesides speaking to Jorge Salazar on the current state of nanotechnology. I'm Lindsay Patterson, and this has been an Earth and Sky presentation.
We're at earthsky.org.